Radio. This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. So, 2010, the federal estate tax, it's been forgotten. And what's going to, what might happen when somebody remembers? And here to tell us all about that is Mark Levine, partner in the law firm Handler & Levine, fellow seminar presenter, and knower of all things estate. Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Bob.
And John Elliott, federal benefit strategist, retired Fed, fellow seminar presenter as well. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob. Good morning, Mark.
Morning.
And good morning to everyone else. It's been a few weeks for me. I had the tax season flu. Anyway, so, Mark, the estate tax federal, let's be real clear here. The federal level, this is the year, if somebody were to pass?
In theory. This is the year the estate tax forgot so far. In all likelihood, it's not going to work out that way. But technically, right now, as we sit, there is no federal estate tax. There's no federal tax on your estate when you pass.
But, what is an estate?
It's a good question because people think of estate and they think of their probate estate. They think of their vast holdings in land and things like that. And what a lot of people don't realize is the minutiae involved in determining what your estate is for federal estate tax purposes, because it's not what passes through probate. It's not what, someone necessarily gets directly from you. I think the most general way to say it is it's a tax on what passes on account of your death, not necessarily what passes directly from you to somebody else.
So it could be things, too. I mean, it could be the shirt off your proverbial back all the way up to money in whatever account.
When you're figuring out your federal estate tax, it includes life insurance in most cases, your TSP, IRAs, 403Bs, your HUMLs, the tools in your garage. It includes your cash, your bank accounts, your brokerage accounts. It includes joint assets that you own with someone else. And there are special rules that deal with joint assets and special rules that deal with assets owned with a spouse and things like that. But generally, the answer, when the question is this included in my estate for tax purposes? The answer is generally, yes, it is.
So if the three of us owned a thing and we each owned a third of it, what happens?
If we own a joint with rights of survivorship and I'm the one who passes away, all of it's includable in my estate unless my estate or you two can prove that you contributed to the asset. You know, one of the great misconceptions people has is if I put my son on my bank account as a joint owner and I die, he'll get it, which is true. He'll get it outside of probate, which is true, and it's going to avoid estate taxes, which is not true at all. If you didn't contribute the equity, it's still going to be included as part of estate taxes in the first person to die. And it's a fairly draconian rule. In other words, IRS doesn't have to prove anything. You have to prove someone else contributed equity. So if all the records burn down in a fire, you're out of luck.
Ouch.
Yeah.
It's funny, you say that. Very sad. On the way down, I was talking with somebody, and a friend of theirs, house burned down this weekend, including a lot of the records.
That's going to create an issue. It creates an issue for joint ownership of any kind. It hits domestic partners, unmarried couples, very, very hard. If you can't prove who contributed to the asset, you may end up paying an estate tax on an asset you already paid for.
If your will is in your house and your house gets destroyed, do you keep a copy as well?
Generally, when we're doing estate planning, we keep the originals because if your will burns down, the presumption is you revoked it. If you can't find the original, the court presumes that you revoked it because one of the ways you revoke a will is by destruction. And so if it's gone, then we have to go to the court with a copy and say, well, here's a copy and here's affidavits, here's evidence that shows that John never intended to revoke it. And that can be successful, but it's a pain.
Okay.
Now, as far as tracking things, if one was to move, if there would be this awful thing like a fire, what do you advise your clients to do to protect the important papers in the event of something awful like that?
I mean, we live in a great time for that because it's easy to scan things. You know, what we tell our clients about jointly owned property where you want to show the ownership later on and who contributed what, scan the statements every month. So, you know, so much of this is done electronically now. There aren't checks. There aren't these sorts of historical records that we've had previously. So scan it. You know, every bank statement that comes in, every evidence of what goes where and how, scan it and store it somewhere. Store it off-site, store it with your attorney. We do have clients who will send us that for this very reason, because we know if one of them passes away, we're going to have to go back and track what the equity is.
Okay. So is it safe to say then, I mean, this is very general, that an estate would be all the assets that one owns, ignoring spouses for a second, would be subject to estate taxes, even if owned by somebody that isn't a spouse or isn't a relative?
Yeah, basically. That's going to go into your gross estate. When they're figuring out you have to file a return, they include everything just about.
Okay. Now, I know it was a significant number prior to 2010. What was the number that one would have to worry about federal estate taxes, the value?
Up until December 31st of 2009, the exemption amount was $3.5 million. That means if your gross estate was less than $3.5 million, you didn't have to file a return. If your net estate, so that's after they deduct all the your mortgage and what you give to charity and what you pay and things like that, if your net estate was less than $3.5 million, you didn't have to pay an estate tax. So it was a pretty high number, but that had grown. The repeal of the estate tax this year started in 2001. When the President and Congress in 2001 repealed the tax, it was a very slow repeal. It went from 675 to a million, from a million to a million and a half, to 2 million, to 3.5 million, to nothing.
But under the old law, it was nothing for 2010, but did it provide for anything in 2011 and later?
So the repeal only lasts 1 year. And at the end of 2010, in theory, the estate tax comes back to what it would have been in 2001 if they had done nothing, which means it'll be a $1 million exemption, and the top tax rate goes from 45%, which is fairly confiscatory, to 55%, which is even more confiscatory. So it becomes a much lower exemption and a much higher tax.
And if you read the proverbial tea leaves, do you see this changing? Do you see it changing, one, when? Who knows? But is there a movement afoot to make that number higher than a million?
The proverbial tea leaves that every estate planning professional has been reading for the last 2 years was that sometime before the end of 2009, they were going to go back and sort of make permanent the 2009 regime. So $3.5 million exemption, 45% tax. Obviously, that didn't happen. We got to the end of 2009 and they did nothing. Now the money is that they will do something before the end of August of 2010. And the reason they've got to do something to save the tax for 2010 if they want to is that they have to do something before the first return would be due. And that's October 1st, 2010. So if you died January 1st, your estate tax return would normally be due October 1st, 2010. So they have to reinstate the tax before then, or in theory, they're going to lose the ability to go back and retroactively tax people. So is that what we think is going to happen? Yeah, I think so. But I wouldn't put money on it this time. It wouldn't surprise me if, you know, they did nothing, if they extended that period and said, okay, we're Congress, we can say that the new filing period is November 1st and do it then. The more politics comes up, we've got a Supreme Court vacancy that they're going to get to argue about this summer. It takes away from dealing with this issue. And this issue has a lot of permutations because it affects capital gains taxes as well.
All right. At the federal level, this might be the year for somebody that unfortunately does pass to pass estate tax-wise. But what if that person also lived, not everybody lives in Maryland, Virginia, and D.C., but all states are different, aren't they?
Yeah. Before 2001, there was basically a unified estate tax system between the states and the feds. And they had worked it out so that you would pay a state rate of about 16%. But you never paid more total than what you owed the feds. So if you owed the feds, and this is very sort of general. But if you owed the feds 100 and you owed the state 16, you paid the state 16 and you paid the feds 84. So no one really cared that there was a state estate tax because you were paying the same amount no matter what.
So you got to subtract it from whatever your federal estate tax.
You basically got a credit. You got a dollar for dollar credit up to a certain amount. And that limit is what the states would set as their estate tax. And then that is part of how they paid for the repeal of the estate tax. So now you don't get that credit anymore. You get a deduction. And a deduction isn't worth as much as a credit. So now you pay both the state and the federal. You just pay a little less state because you're getting a credit essentially with – or a deduction with the feds. The bigger issue is that a lot of states had said their entire estate tax was – our tax is whatever the feds will give us credit. So when the feds got rid of the credit, those states' tax just disappeared. So one day Florida had an estate tax and the next day they didn't. And they never reinstated it. Some states had a separate tax. Other states said, you know what? We kind of need this money. We didn't agree to get rid of it. We didn't get any of the benefit from getting rid of it. So we're going to reinstate the estate tax. So there's now, I think, 20 states – including D.C., 21 including Puerto Rico, that have a separate state-level estate tax.
Outside of – well, let's do Maryland, Virginia, D.C. very quickly, but then let's go outside of it if you can.
Sure.
It's – you know, we're both tax guys, and if you were to ask me a question about Nebraska taxes, I'd go, Okay, so let's start with Maryland. Does Maryland have an estate tax?
Maryland has a separate state-level of estate tax, and the exemption's $1 million.
Okay, how about D.C.?
$1 million exemption also.
How about Virginia?
Virginia repealed their estate tax in 2007. There have been bills to reanimate it, but I don't expect any of them are going to get traction right now.
Yay.
Okay. All right, outside of the metro D.C., of the states that you know, who's got one?
Luckily, I have a list, but I want to say, you know, John said yay because Virginia doesn't have one.
That's where I live.
That's
obviously.
I figured. But what I would be careful of is that as states start running out of money even further than they have, they're going to start looking at old taxes. And so, for example, some states that we never thought would have an estate tax again, states that don't have an income tax, that pride themselves on certain things. So Delaware, for example, you know, doesn't have an income tax, I think. And we thought they wouldn't have an estate tax. Well, back in July, they reinstituted their estate tax. And I think you may see that as time goes on and states start looking for other sources of revenue. So Delaware has a separate estate tax. It comes in at a $3.5 million exemption. So essentially, if you fit under the old federal regime, you're going to have to pay a Delaware tax as well.
You bring up an interesting point, at least to me. On the income tax side, they do have one, but they don't have a sales tax.
Okay.
And they have a fairly large exemption for somebody retired there. So if Delaware's population was gaining with retirees and they go, here's a potential source, but at $3.5 million, that source might be smaller than what one would think.
Right. The thing to also remember, though, is it applies not only to people who live in that state, but to anyone who owns real estate in that state. So John, of course, is a real estate mogul. He lives in Virginia, so there's no estate tax, but he owns real estate in Maryland. That Maryland real estate is going to pull him into the Maryland estate tax regime, even if the total amount of the property in Maryland is less than $1 million. So it's not just where you live, it's also where you own real estate.
So it's kind of like sometimes when people work in different locations, they may live in a state, but if they work in another state, they might have to pay state income tax to that. I'm making this overly simplistic. So it's not undifferent here.
Correct.
If we own assets.
Real estate primarily.
Yeah.
You know, in theory, it's other assets that have a situs, that have their location there.
You can touch and feel rather than like a bank account because the corporate headquarters is in Wisconsin.
Exactly.
They can't tax you.
But in theory, if John kept all of his gold Cougarans in a Maryland safe deposit box, then that could be an issue as well.
Where do you keep them, John?
South Africa.
So other states.
Notice he didn't miss a beat with that.
Well, he knows. I'm pretty sure he tells
the
street.
Just don't know.
Right. Other states, Ohio has a separate state estate tax. It comes in at $340,000. New Jersey is $675,000. Rhode Island is $850,000.
$675,000 in Jersey.
Yep.
It's very interesting because there's, you know, Jersey is a moneyed state.
Yeah. It's low. I mean, they basically never changed off of where it was in 2000. Rhode Island did something interesting. They're the first jurisdiction to index their estate tax for inflation. And so it's at $850,000, but it will actually increase to the extent that we get inflation. So, let's see.
How about do you know California? I don't mean to put you on the spot.
I have a list, so that's okay. California does not have a separate state-level estate tax.
How long that's going to last.
I think this is an issue. I think that a lot of people look at these lists and go, okay, well, this is a good place to go because they don't have an estate tax. And I think that those things could change, and they could change pretty rapidly when they start looking, you know, who are the people who don't complain that much? Dead people are a group of people who don't tend to complain that much. And so they may start looking at estates as a source of funds.
But pre-death, they might complain bitterly because – you know, they say, well, I've worked all my life and I've accumulated this estate and I'd like to pass it on to my kids, and you're going to tax the bejesus out of it, and so forth and so on. So that's, I guess, why.
There's a real constitution. I mean, there is a constitutional argument that people say, oh, it's double taxation. And what we know the answer is it's not double taxation. And we know that because the Supreme Court says it's not. But their position is it's two separate taxes, one time each. It's not the same tax twice. And double taxation is the same tax twice.
Well, you'd be the survivors, in effect, would be taxed.
But I
can understand that logic.
Yeah. Right.
I can understand that.
So that's the position, that it is a constitutional tax. The question is whether or not it's a fair tax. And that's a policy decision.
Let me ask you another question. And, just coming out of tax season, Hades, this came up a couple times, and in the tax law, correct me if I'm wrong, let's say somebody owns stock or mutual funds and they were to unfortunately pass, the beneficiary would be able to take that same asset, and if they in theory sold it the same day the person passed, they'd pay no tax whatsoever, even though the person who had passed had a large gain built up into it. So the gain kind of goes with the individual. But that's not always the case with things like IRAs, but in our listening audience, the thrift. It might, in fact, be taxed at the estate level, and it's also taxed at the individual beneficiary's income tax.
Yes.
Yeah.
The income tax always has to get paid. There's income in respect of the decedent, which is something that someone can use once they inherit it. But essentially, the income tax always has to get paid. You don't get out of that. And so unlike gain, a capital gain, which you have what's called an unlimited step up in basis in theory, not this year, the way the taxes are set up, but in 2009, for example, if your mom and dad paid $50,000 for a house and you inherit it and it's worth $400,000 and you sell it for $400,000, you don't pay any capital gains tax. In theory, this year they have what's called carryover basis, which means that you have to pay tax based on what
Mom and dad sold it.
That's how they paid for the estate tax repeal. If you look at the numbers of how they paid to repeal the estate tax, because you always have to find money to replace the money that you're not bringing in anymore, in theory, they did it by getting rid of the unlimited step-up in basis. So a lot more people will pay a tax with the estate taxes repealed. It's just that they're going to pay it at a lower level than people were paying the estate tax.
I'm going to ask you a question, and I don't mean to put you on the spot. I don't know the answer to this. Using that example, mom and dad pass in their residence, and they've lived there for a number of years, so they meet the special test with regards to not paying taxes at the federal level if they had sold the house while living. So the beneficiary inherits it. Do they get the same rule, the 2 out of 5? Of course, they wouldn't have lived there, but the
right.
parents would have.
They don't get the rule, per se, but they also don't need it. There is a rule that a spouse can maintain their spouse's half of that exemption after they die, I think for 2 years. But more importantly, mom and dad are concerned about that because they bought the house for $450,000 and it's worth $700,000. And if they sell it, they have a $650,000 gain. But if daughter inherits that house, for her basis is $700,000. So if she sells it tomorrow, she doesn't need that exemption. So no, she doesn't get her parents' exemption.
She doesn't need it.
She doesn't need it.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
All right. Now, let's say that I always like marching through the stages of one's career. Let's start at the beginning. Somebody listening to the show calls you up. But by the way, how does somebody get in touch with you?
Glad you asked. You can reach me. Our phone number is 301-961-6464. And my email address is mark, M-A-R-C, at handlerlevine.com, handlerlevine.com. And so our website's www.handlerlevine.com, handlerlevine.com.
Okay.
That's Mark with a C.
Mark with a C. Okay, Mark with a C. If somebody were to call you up or come in and meet with you and say, yeah, I'm early stage of my career, I'm late 20s, early 30s, is it too early for me to be concerned about estate taxes?
Oddly and sort of counterintuitively, younger people sometimes have a bigger estate tax issue because they've got kids and life insurance. Everyone thinks life insurance is exempt from tax. It's exempt from income tax when you inherit it. It is not exempt from your estate tax. It's part of your estate for estate tax purposes. And so we have young people. You've got three kids. You've got $1 million or $2 million or more of life insurance. All of that counts for your estate for estate tax purposes.
Is there an end around for that?
Usually we use what's called a bypass or credit shelter trust, where you want to make sure you use your exemption at the first death. The issue with married couples is if you leave everything outright to the surviving spouse, at their death, they can't go back in time and use your exemption. So for Marilyn, for example, you've got $1 million exemption, not a $2 million exemption. But if we plan correctly and use that exemption at the first death, we can double it. We can make sure that you use $2 million worth of exemption rather than just $1 million. So it's really important if you're married, if you have life insurance, you sort of have to deal with it, and you don't expect to, because people come in and say, I've got nothing, but you dig into what they have, and they have this life insurance policy.
Speaking of life insurance, of course, you're going to designate beneficiaries, obviously, spouse and then maybe children. But let's say you don't include the life insurance in your will or trust. It's just the policy with the beneficiaries. How is that treated? I mean, you've said that life insurance is part of your estate, but do you get any escape route through that?
It's included exactly the same way. In other words, a beneficiary designation is just another way that assets transfer at death, like joint ownership, like a will, like a trust. There is something called an irrevocable life insurance trust, where you can have the insurance owned by this other trust. You can't revoke it. You can't change it. There's a lot of technical rules about it. But if you do it correctly, it's not included as part of your estate for estate tax purposes. But generally, when you're doing those beneficiary designations, it's really important to make sure that they're going in the same directions as your will says. So if you've set up a trust for your kids, you have to make sure that the beneficiary designation doesn't say pay my kids, because it won't go in the trust. It'll go straight to the kids. It has to say to the trust. The trust has to be the beneficiary. So you want to tie those things together, and you do that also when you're planning to use those exemptions, to do that estate tax exemption doubling.
Okay. If the life insurance is owned by a trust, how does a trust buy life insurance?
The trustee buys it. Essentially, someone's named, so I have a life insurance trust. I'm the grantor. My wife is the trustee. She signs the application for the life insurance on my life. And so she's the representative of the trust, and she's the one who pays the premium, and she's the one who's in charge of it as the trustee of the trust.
Okay, before you drink your next sip of coffee, can I go out and buy life insurance on yours and John's life?
Not unless you have an insurable interest in John and I. So
I do, to make the show click for the next half hour.
Good luck with that. Generally, no. You need to have an insurable interest in someone. There has to be a reason why my dying will affect you in some way. And so that's why sometimes business partners could. Certainly children, spouses, relatives, people in those situations, they have an insurable interest in the person that life insurance is on.
Okay, so the trust then could buy it. I'm sure the insured has to pay some type of medical test.
All the same stuff. Yeah.
But how does it get money to pay the premium? A trust can't go out and work. There's got to be some money coming from somewhere.
There does. I mean, the grantor is going to contribute money to the trust.
What's a grantor?
The person who created it. So this case, I'm the grantor. I'm the person who created the trust. I'm going to write a check to my wife as the trustee of the trust. She's the person in charge of the trust. And then she'll pay the premium. And there are a lot of other technical requirements for this kind of trust, but that's the basic way that it flows.
Okay, so that's an end around because, like you say, somebody in the early stages of the career has more of a need for life insurance and sizable life insurance, mm-hmm. and they should watch out and maybe consider this life insurance trust rather than just leave it, if you will, naked.
Yeah, and also just doing sort of general bypass trust planning will usually work. There'll usually be enough of an exemption for people. Certainly if you live in Virginia, in this area or another state that doesn't have a state level estate tax, you don't necessarily have to go to the length of a life insurance trust. Just doing the planning within the will or the revocable trust would work.
Wow. What other planning opportunities are there for somebody in the early stages of one's career?
You know, it really depends on where your money's coming from and where it's going, and are you likely to inherit money, and are you likely to inherit other things? I think for a lot of people, certainly early, all their money's in the TSP, all their money is in education planning for their kids, and all their money's in life insurance and a house, let's say. There really aren't a lot of other things you do planning-wise. You look at that bypass trust, you make sure things are going to flow into these trusts to use each other's exemptions and make sure that when you're both gone, as little as possible is going to be taxed when it goes to the kids. But unless you're doing a lot of investing in real estate or a lot of sort of consulting or LLCs or things like that, doing other things, there's really not a lot you do. You just make sure that you know the money's going to be safe, that it's going to be used by someone, and that the trustee, the person who's in charge, has the flexibility to deal with your kids and their needs when you and your spouse are gone.
Let's say you set up a trust because you have minor children.
Mm-hmm.
And then they become adults. And you also feel that, yeah, if they inherited your money, they would be responsible and they wouldn't go out and buy a lot of stuff. Is there any point in changing your will when they cross the 21 threshold? Or
I don't think it's an age threshold so much. I think it's a responsibility threshold. I have a lot of clients who have kids who are 25 who they don't ever want
Understood,
to inherit money.
Yeah.
And I have people with clients, you know, who have kids who are 21 who they think could handle it tomorrow. I think you're going to end up changing it. You know, my kids are little, 10, 7, and 4. I have a trust that goes till they're 40. I hope when they're 20, I'm going to say, well, that was ridiculous. These are good kids. I'm going to make that trust till they're 30. I hope when they're 25, I'm going to say, I don't need a trust at all for these kids. They're good kids. They could handle the money.
Okay.
So you're definitely going to be looking to adjust it as time goes on.
I see. And you should. So
Absolutely.
Let's say in your case, you're son or daughter reaches 25 and you say, hey, I can completely trust them with this large amount of money,
mm-hmm.
or any amount of money. Should you then change it? Or can you just let it ride anyway?
Right. You absolutely should look closely at doing it, especially for your TSP, especially for any tax-deferred account, because the income tax benefit of it going directly to them rather than going to a trust is tremendous. For anything else, it's really a question of how's the trust structured. In other words, the trust for my kids, my sister as the trustee can give them everything early or can hold it till later, depending on who they are. So there's a lot of flexibility there. I might not feel like, maybe she could handle it, but it doesn't hurt her to have that money held off
mm-hmm.
and have her go to work. Whereas with my IRA, at 25, if I trust her, I'm going to put that in her name because the income tax benefit of that is tremendous.
Well, let's reverse that question. Two reversals, the awful one first. Let's say there's a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
What do I scramble with? I'm certainly going to change one beneficiary.
Sure.
And do I then take that same person off as the trustee of the trust?
You better. In other words, if you're getting a divorce, if you're separated, if you move out, you want to change your estate planning. You want to change your beneficiary designations. You want to change your power of attorney, your health care directive, and that trust for your kids. Now, sometimes people have really great relationships, and I have clients who still want their ex-spouse as the trustee for their kids' money. Most of my clients who are divorced don't. You know, a lot of times money is the root of the problems, and they don't trust their spouse with that money. They don't want them to be the trustee. And so you have to restructure. A lot of times with people who are divorcing, we'll meet with a client early in the process to get things sort of done, and then we'll meet them at the end of the process to see what money's been split, where everything is, what they're required to do, and make sure the estate plan still works for that.
Let's do then the next step. Somebody never married but had a very active singlehood,
mm-hmm.
and they've left all their money to the resort, Sandals, and Club Med. What do they do? I guess they're going to change the beneficiaries.
Yeah, the beneficiary designations, you know, even if you have used up all your money, you still have the life insurance and hopefully a TSP and hopefully a lump sum payment from FERS. And so you want to make sure if you care where that's going, You have to make sure that you have a will, that you have a structure for it to go there. If it's a lot and you really can't stand the idea of it being used to pay estate taxes, you can give it to charity. Charities don't pay any estate taxes. So if you leave it all to the church, then it all goes to the church. It doesn't go to pay estate taxes on that money first.
So that's a good point. Sometimes in class, people will ask, well, what money should I spend first? And, you know, it just depends. But let's say you spend the non-taxable money first, not the thrift money, not the IRA money, and somebody was fortunate enough to have a lot, maybe more than what the family needed, or there was no family. So could things like IRAs and thrifts then be given, if you will, to a charity, and that would escape the estate tax?
Absolutely.
Now, of course, it escapes the economic benefit to any beneficiary, but it would escape the estate tax.
If you have a charitable intent, then you leaving the TSP or your IRA to the charity is a great way to leave money to charity, because they get the full benefit. They get a dollar-for-dollar benefit. There's no income tax issues. There's no estate tax issues. It's the most efficient thing to do with it from a purely income tax point of view. Everybody else in the world's got to pay that income tax sooner or later, some way or another.
Okay. Now, I bet there's some people that have some questions, and we're here now. Again, we're live, and it's 10:36, and it's April, what is today, April 19th?
I think so.
Yeah. April 19th, and it's the AM, and we're off in about 22 minutes, about 10:58. So if you're listening to it other than that time, don't call, because there won't be anybody to answer it. But you can email us, and the show is archived on nitpinc.com, left-hand side, it says For Your Benefit Radio Show. Click on, and you can listen to this and others as well. However, for those listening and want to talk live, we're at 877-936-9333. 877-936-9333. Let's march on up to now the person at the mid-career level. They come in and they got a mortgage that's choking them, and they're trying to save every bit they can for the college education plans, and they're doing okay, but there isn't a lot of discretionary money floating around. How do you help them?
Yeah, it's a lot of the same issues. Until you get out of that need for the life insurance for the kids, you're really looking for these people as well, because again, most of their money, if they've done what they've been told to do, is they're putting it in, they're stuffing it into the TSP as much as they can. They're using college savings plans and things like that, and they have life insurance. And as long as that life insurance is there, you have that estate tax issue. As the TSP grows, you have a different issue, which is we really don't want to put the TSP in a trust if we don't have to, certainly at the first death. And so that becomes more of a balancing act of, you know, how are we going to fund these exemption trusts that we talked about as the insurance falls away, because you don't need it anymore. You know, two of your three kids are out of college, and so instead of having $2 million of insurance, you've chopped it down to $1 million of insurance or less. And so we start losing that insurance money, which for a lot of people means they don't have an estate tax issue. But for other people, it means, you know, we still have a small estate tax issue. And the first thing I always say to clients is, do you care? Are you willing to do anything during your life that makes anything at all more difficult for you during your life in order to preserve estate taxes and not have to pay them when the money goes to your kids? And sometimes people are like, you know what? I got them through college. Whatever they get, they get. It's a windfall. Other people are adamant that not a penny goes to pay taxes, and they want they'll do anything so that every penny can go to their kids. And so you look at things like splitting up assets, making sure that if you look at a column of what the husband has and what the wife has, those columns are as even as possible, even if it means you're moving money around from one to the other. And using those funds to fund what we call the bypass trust or the credit shelter trust at the first death. And it's all about what's left at the second death and how do we minimize that within a framework that works for your lifestyle, that makes sense for what you want to do, because there's a tax answer and there's a life answer, and they don't always meet up.
I seem to, at least in my world, I get the tax question first. I don't want my heirs to pay any inheritance tax. I don't want them to pay any probate taxes, and this is what I'm going to do. And I'm skipping to the pre-retirees, but oftentimes they go, I want to take the money out of the IRA now, and I want to pay the tax so my heirs won't. And my response, and maybe I'm all wet with this, when I said, let them pay tax on more money by keeping the money in there. And it doesn't always hold true. Does that make any sense?
You know, I think from a life point of view, you want to have control of the money. You want to have as many options for your life as possible. And then you want to do estate tax planning as the second part of that. So does this work for me, taking this money and taking it out and paying the tax on it and then gifting it to my kids? Does that work from a cash flow point of view for my life? Does it work for any point of view for my life? And if it doesn't, then the fact that you're going to pay less estate taxes at the end doesn't really matter. At the end of the day, you want as much money. You want to grow your money as much as possible. You do want to gift it. You do want to transfer it to your kids if you can afford to do that. And just like for you, for me, the first thing we look at is the tax issue. What are you going to pay in estate taxes, and what could we do to reduce it, and what should you do to reduce it? And now, how do you feel about that? And, you know, if it doesn't fit with your life, you can't do it.
And what Mark is saying holds true for somebody that's married as well as somebody that isn't.
Sure.
Because they're going to be heirs for somebody that isn't. Maybe it's going to be relatives. Maybe they don't have any relatives. Maybe they don't have any friends, but then who cares?
There's no question. People are much more cognizant of trying to save the money and preserve it for their kids than for nieces and nephews. When it's all going to nieces and nephews, they sort of say, yeah, it's a windfall to them. If they have to pay more tax, if they have to have a harder time getting it, I don't care. I'm not willing to be inconvenienced in my life now at all to make it easier for these people to inherit. Whereas when it's your kids, people are much more willing, and I would say the majority of time will be inconvenienced in their life and will do things to maximize what their kids are going to get.
Yeah, my uncle passed a couple years ago to a ripe age of 99. And, of course, everything was going to go – they had no children, was married, but all was going to go to his sisters. Happened to be my mom, and my mom unfortunately passed, and I wound up with it. But I just thought to myself, I bet he probably didn't necessarily – want me to have it. Not that we didn't get along. We got along great, but he probably had some favorite charities, but I couldn't figure out what they were through his attorney. And
you know, one of the worst situations I had was a guy who we did, he had a lot of money, and we had done an estate plan for him. We were supposed to sign it, and he was actually in the hospital. And he called me. I was going to come out there, and he called me. He said, you know what, come by tomorrow. They're moving me to rehab on Thursday. Come by on Friday. I'll be settled, and we can sign everything. And, of course, Thursday he passed away. Mm. So instead of $2 million going to his church and $2 million going to his friends, it went to money. It went to people, his nieces and nephews, some of whom he was very close to, and literally some of whom he didn't know existed when he died. And they were the proverbial, you know, he was the proverbial rich lost uncle. And that's not what he would have wanted. That's not where he wanted it to go. But if you don't do planning, you don't control that.
I only had one.
That you know of.
That I know of.
What about pets?
Pets is a big issue.
Wolf, yes.
There's about, I think, 42 or 43 states that have pet trusts that are authorized. Maryland just authorized a pet trust in the last legislative session. So now in this area, certainly all three jurisdictions do allow for pet trusts. And they're significant. For some people, it's a very big deal. You know, you don't do a pet trust for a goldfish, but I have a client with four big dogs, and it was really important to her what's going to happen to these dogs and how are they going to live until they pass away. And so we set up a fairly intricate system and a trust and caretakers and all of those things to take care of those pets. And for her, that was the primary thing she was concerned about.
It's interesting. I have a called a friend who's a vet, and they take care, I won't say of a significant number of animals, but some, and they're set up with the trust, and the vet has to account to mm-hmm. somebody where the money goes, and at the end of the day, it goes off to some university.
A lot of times what you'll find with pet trusts is the money's set aside for the pet, and when the pet's gone, it goes to the Humane Society, or it goes to some other charity. It doesn't Most people aren't usually choosing between their pets and people. What I find most people are choosing between their pets and a charity, and they're sort of delaying what the charity gets. But we certainly have some that if the pet wasn't there, people would inherit more.
Okay. Now, the pre-retiree or a couple years beyond, you know, they've their life is in focus, their income is somewhat in focus, especially our listening group. There's going to be a substantial pension that's, as best we know, guaranteed. And they've accumulated whatever assets. And they may still not be over $3.5 million, but they could get caught at the state, state level.
Absolutely. It's not that hard at the second death to get to $1 million. Certainly in this area, and I think in many areas, when you look at the pension, when you look at the amount of money that you're going to have there and have built up, the value in the house, the TSP, things like that. So we really do, again, want to look at, you know, in this case, usually life insurance has fallen off, so we don't have a big life insurance, or if we do, it's going to end when they retire. And so we're really looking at what are the hard assets now. These are real assets. This is cash. These are investment accounts, things like that. And now we're looking at putting those into that trust rather than putting the life insurance in and making sure at death. And we're not really differentiating here between whether you do this through a will or you do it through a revocable trust. We're really talking about when you die, where does this money go? And you want to make sure that these hard assets are going into the trust so that you, again, use both exemptions. Use an exemption at the first death by putting money in a trust. And then at the second death, the survivor has their exemption to use, and all the money then goes to their heirs, goes to their kids, their families, etc.
Okay, now let's say that, again, they don't have kids and they've got nieces and nephews, or they don't have nieces and nephews. They're single and they've got some money stuffed away in the TSP, maybe some IRAs, and maybe they've got their home paid for. How do you pull out of them where they want it to go?
You just sit down and talk. You really just have to talk to people. Most people, if you have a conversation with them, and we send out a questionnaire. You know, people will download it from the website. They'll fill it in, or we'll email it to them. And that tells us what they have. And sometimes they know where they want it to go. But very often, it's just a question of sitting down and saying, okay, they've thought through, if I'm gone, I want her to have everything. And she's thought, if I'm gone, I want him to have everything. Okay, now when you're both gone, where does it go? What do you want to happen? And that is sometimes something they've thought about, and often something they haven't really given a lot of thought to. And you just sit down and you sort of find out. And a lot of times spouses are finding out for the first time from each other, where do you want it to go if you're gone? Where do you want it to go if you're gone? And how then we work on how do we accomplish that.
Okay. As children age, as friends age, some need it more than others later on. Do you find sometimes that, let's say a parent, not that everybody's a parent, well, you know, this one did pretty good, but this one will never be good with money. I'd like to leave it, but I want it in a trust. And like, say, until they're 40 or 50 even, mm-hmm. Or a special needs trust if, unfortunately, they're disabled. Do you find any kind of discrimination there to say, okay, this one's never going to worry about money, but this one's always going to worry about money?
I think there's a line, and once that sort of line is crossed, there's much more worry. There's sort of the people who just aren't good with money, you know. Brother's very successful. I mean, son's very successful. Daughter's not that successful. Younger daughter's very successful. And the parents, unless they really have taken over this caretaker role for the middle child, their preference usually is just leave it all equally. I want all three of them getting the same amount. But then you have the situation where middle daughter has a problem. If it's a physical disability, if she receives government benefits, you really need to have some sort of special needs trust. And that's a very specific sort of document you need to create.
That special needs trust, coincidentally, just the other day came up on the Today Show.
Mm-hmm.
A woman queried the Today Show, I guess, and she had a special needs child and two other non-special needs children. And she asked, well, what do I do? She was concerned about the special needs child mm-hmm. if her husband and she passed. Or when her husband passed, and they asked her, the expert, do you have a will? And she said, no. And I screamed at the TV set. I said, you stupid, whatever. But it was incredible. But yeah, that the expert, Chatsky woman,
right.
Said you set up a special needs trust.
And sometimes...
And how does that work exactly?
That's an hour and a half in and of itself.
Oh, okay,
but,
all right.
But you
should inquire about
absolutely.
It if you have a special needs child.
And the mistake people make is, I'll leave everything to my daughter and she'll take care of my son. And that's not always something that works out, either because the daughter doesn't or because the daughter dies and the money goes elsewhere. So if you have a physical disability, if you have a child that's got a drug problem or an alcohol problem or a mental issue, you may set up trusts for them that are going to continue forever, but with opportunities for them to, you know, show their sobriety or go to rehab and have the trust pay for those sorts of things. I think one of the things that I get a lot is people wanting to make sure that the hypothetical daughter-in-law never sees any of the money. And what you have to understand is once you give the money to your child, you can't control where it goes. So if you really think that 22-year-old child is great, remember, once they get the money, you can't say, but if they mess up later, it comes back. Once it's theirs, it's theirs. And so having a trust continue, certainly for a younger child like that, is important. But most people sort of, you have to realize you can't control if it goes to the daughter-in-law or the son-in-law once it's gone to your child. And so you really just have to think about who they are and what kinds of controls you're willing to put in.
I read years ago, we'll leave the names out, an owner of a professional sports team put into their will that if any of the children bid on the team, they were disinherited. You know, if everybody isn't mm-hmm. related to somebody with a sports team, but it could be the same thing. How do you do that?
Well, you can put restrictions on the money in a trust that you leave to someone. They can't violate public policy, but certainly saying that this person can't bid on a sports team doesn't violate any public policy. So you could have controls like that. You can say that the house is there for them to live in as long as they're living there. And if they move out, the house gets sold and the money gets split up among the other kids. You can certainly do that. You can say that the child's not going to get the money unless they've completed rehab and doctors or therapists or whatever the appropriate authority has given them sort of a pass for a number of years or something like that. So you can have all sorts of conditions on the money. What you can't do and what clients always want to say is, well, my son's 30. He's great. I want him to have the money, but I just want to make sure that my daughter-in-law can never get it. And that's what you can't do. You can't give it outright, let him put it in his pocket, and somehow control what he does with it. If you want to control from the grave, you got to control from the grave. You either get to be simple or you get to have control. You don't get both.
Okay, my mind runs to goofy movies, and there was this great movie, Brewster's Millions, and it was Richard Pryor, and he had to spend a certain amount of money within a certain amount of time. He had to, and then he got a gazillion more dollars. I mean, I don't think most people do that. But
not yet. No one's done that yet, but that would be good. You could do that.
Okay, so... And then final analysis, I think we walked through each stage of one's career and we looked at single people, not single people, ex-married people. Domestic partners, are there any issues with that?
There's some interesting – there's no federal estate tax recognition of domestic partners. The different states do. So D.C., for example, a domestic partner or a spouse now in D.C. Has the same rights as any other spouse. Maryland just came out with an attorney general's opinion that said they will recognize a same-sex partnership, for example, that has been made into a marriage in D.C., for example, or another state, as a marriage. Maryland has some exemptions for inheritance tax for domestic partners. So it's really, really state by state, and your assumption has to be that you have no protection, that I'm going to be treated exactly like my neighbor if money is left to me from my domestic partner. And so there's a lot more planning that has to be done. You know, I think that the takeaway from the estate tax, I mean, I think one of the big things is people hear the estate tax is gone or it's coming back or it's this or it's that, is the estate tax is going to exist. It's going to exist in some form or another. It's going to be more than $1 million on the federal level, but it's not going away. If I had to bet, I'd bet it's going to be $3.5 million, but I ain't betting a lot these days on that proposition. So there's going to be something, and we're all going to sort of learn what it is together over the course of this next several months.
And there are exceptions. We were talking before we went on air that not that we have a lot of family farmers locally, or probably not in the whole country listening to the show, but don't farms or special things like that get a discount from what they're really worth because they produce agricultural products?
Well, this is one of the big issues with the gap between the federal and the state tax. Yes, on a federal level, there's something called a special use valuation where if you have a working farm, you can get it valued as a working farm as long as you agree to continue working it as a farm. You can't get a lesser valuation and then turn around and turn it into condos. You have to keep working it. Most states will follow that as long as you're filing a federal tax return. But if you live in a state that doesn't, that has a lower exemption, for example, Maryland, and doesn't have a special use valuation, you're stuck in that situation where if you had a $5 million farm, you're fine. But a $2 million farm and you've got a big problem because you don't have enough to register for the federal estate tax and get that exception, but you still have more than the Maryland tax allows. And there's a lot of what we call gap issues that are coming up that the federal government would allow something, the state would allow it as long as you were filing a federal return, but now that you're not, they don't allow it. And so how spouses are treated in D.C., for example, if you have between $1 million and $3.5 million, is very different than how they're treated in Maryland, for example. And you can do more in Maryland than you can in D.C. with spouses. So there's a lot more complexity than there used to be.
Okay, one last question. In retirement, a number of people have a small business. Sometimes mid-career they have a small business. Are there special valuations for small businesses, or do they just kind of go when the person goes?
It depends if it's saleable. If you have inventory, if you have a business that can be sold to somebody, sure, you might have to have it valued and you're going to have to pay an estate tax on it. If it's really just a pure personal services business, then it's really accounts receivable. You know, what's left to come in, and that's what the business is worth because it's not worth anything. But it still gets valued, and that's something you have to plan for and talk to your attorney about how does that get dealt with if something happens to me.
Okay, we've got 1 minute. Final comments, thoughts. When should somebody come see you?
Tomorrow.
I know, as soon as we get off air. But
you know, estate planning, there's so many things that everybody needs, whether you're rich or poor, whether you're married or single. But if you have kids, if you have life insurance, if you have any of these issues at all, you need to do estate planning. And you need to talk to somebody who can walk you through what's going to be appropriate for you, because I guarantee you there are things you haven't thought about.
Okay, this was very informative. I learned some things. John?
Just bye-bye.
Okay. Well put, and I think I'll say this thing. Bye-bye, thanks for listening, and we'll be on next week.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
WFED, Washington. WWFD, Frederick. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Federal News Radio in a Web 2.0 world. Find Federal News Radio on Facebook and Twitter. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FedNewsRadio or join the Federal News Radio group on Facebook. Chat with our team and make connections with others in the federal arena. Email us at fnrcomment@federalnewsradio.com. Visit our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, your source for federal news now. Are you on Facebook? Do you Twitter? So does Federal News Radio. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FedNewsRadio or join the Federal News Radio Facebook group. For the latest in federal news and government contracting, visit our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. While you're